Welcome to The World Below, The War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the adventure, the intrigue, and the magic of a land that lies beneath the celestial battle between gods and demons, a clash that has gone on since time immemorial. I'm your guide, your interlocutor, and your host, Michael Pryor. Welcome, everyone, to episode 24 of the World Below the War in the Heavens podcast, the fourth of season three. This one is all about Yefin the Bloody, King of Anarquist. Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Pryor, and let me just say that this episode is, again, intense. Perhaps all that's left is a place dark and lonely. That's the way with history sometimes, isn't it? The Overview. Yefin was born in the year 323. He ascended to the throne on the death of his brother Zalman in 385 and reigned for 2 years, dying in the year 387. His reign featured lots of terror, lots of extreme punishments, lots of harsh laws, and some extremely strange, self-indulgent behaviour. 2 years of reign doesn't lend itself to a lengthy overview, and that's it. The Early Years. Like his siblings, Yefin was banished from the palace in his early teens at a time when his mother, Queen Grippina, was extremely paranoid about her heirs and their ambitions. The life on the fringes of Anarquistian territory, way out in the northwest, was harsh, a military upbringing in many ways. Yefin, according to the sources, was the unhappiest of the siblings with this way of life, and greatly missed the attractions and comforts of the capital. He chafed under the supervision of the border fort's commanders, and he didn't take well at all to the military training that was part of the reason for their being there. It's said that he spent time in minor vandalism, venting his frustration on public buildings, and even, it was rumoured, setting fire to the extensive stables there. Yefin would go missing for days at a time, either in the small town around the fort, or disappearing into the wilderness by himself. He'd never give an account of what he did, apart from shrugging and mumbling about hunting. His siblings tolerated him but were wary of his volcanic rages, which could be provoked by the most minor of things. Although slight of build, if he felt insulted, he'd throw himself at anyone, no matter how large, and the frenzy of his attack would often overcome the strongest of foes. This behaviour came worse to the point where Yefin was known to attack people at random for no reason at all, and it was only the deep pockets of the family that forestalled a major scandal when Yefin almost beat the son of the local high ecclesiast to death. When confronted with evidence of his crime, he merely shrugged and claimed to have no memory of the encounter, despite his bruised knuckles and the blood on his face. On his mother's death, he rushed to the capital for the coronation of his older brother Zalman, but was notably absent from the ceremony itself, having thrown himself into the fleshly delights of the city, and he failed to surface in time. Zalman was wary of his brother's weaknesses, but indulged him, as keeping him close by was better than having him up to unknown and potentially troubling business. The succession having been organised by Queen Grippina, their mother, no strife occurred on what we'd call a handover. Yefin's coronation was the day after Zalman's death, a record for the Anarquist dynasty, where a coronation may often take place weeks after the death of the monarch, to allow a seemly period of mourning. Yefin made sure he didn't have to wait that long. He wanted to be king and to indulge himself to the fullest, which he did. Reign highlights. Well, the reign of terror continues. In many ways, Yefin followed in the footsteps of his mother and his brother. When a family comes to power through brutal, bloody methods, it seems like the only way they can deal with issues is in the same brutal and bloody manner. Yefin continued with a regime of harsh laws and even harsher punishments, with the view to stifle dissent before it even had a chance to start. Spies and informants were aplenty, and the populace pretty much lived in fear, not knowing who to trust. But Yefin was different from his mother and his brother in that he was less studied, less organised, and perhaps less intelligent. He was prone to violent mood swings, and his behaviour from an early age was unpredictable. As king, the absolute monarch with absolute power, this sort of thing was dangerous. Beforehand, he had some limits on his behaviour, either via the formidable presence of his mother or the stern oversight of his older brother Zalman. With these removed from the scene, Yefin was a potential disaster. Initially, the people of Anarquist had their hopes aroused that Yefin would be a monarch different from his mother and brother, because in those initial days the court and the palace became a place of music, art and frivolity, something that had been missing for years. Yefin quickly became known for his outrageous wardrobe, often changing his clothes 4 or 5 times a day, and always into something more flamboyant than before. He loved shininess in his garments, and gold and silver threads worked into the cloth became his hallmark, and small gems and pearls adorning his extravagant clothing also appealed greatly to him. Several species of brightly coloured birds on the far northern island of Vesbesili were hunted to extinction simply to provide the garish plumes he favoured in his headgear. It soon became clear, however, that being a member of the court that clustered around him like so many colourful flowers was a precarious thing. If you were in the king's favour, he could shower you with riches, but if he took a disliking to you, and it was never clear how a disliking could be prompted, you could find yourself being whisked away to the dungeons. As Yefin's reign stretched into months, however, he began to promote the public executions in a way that even his mother and brother hadn't, making them spectacles of the highest order. The arena, too, became the venue for massive staged fights to the death and horrible executions of the few prisoners who were left to die. Yefin was far less calculating and organised than his mother and a brother. He was precipitous, condemning people on a whim and, occasionally, pardoning them moments later. Several brave figures from the aristocracy tried counselling the new king to more moderate behaviour, but they quickly learned the folly of such advice and became part of the ever-burgeoning schedule of executions. In one of his few examples of planning and organisation, he founded an executioner's school to train the people needed to cope with the many executions he was ordering. People came from all over the continent to train, as the pay and conditions were good. So in some ways, it could be said to have been a success. Yefin's strange behaviour. Here are some examples of King Yefin's idiosyncratic conduct. For instance, in the second year of his reign, Yefin's behaviour became even more mercurial. After having favoured musicians in the palace, late in the year, he suddenly announced a complete ban on music, not just in the palace, but in the entire land of Anarquist. Professional musicians were banished, and if they didn't leave within 1 week, they'd be executed. Amateur musicians were given permission simply to give up the practice. All musical instruments were to be destroyed, and singing was forbidden. A week later, Yefin rescinded the ban when he found himself humming a once popular tune. Of course, it was too late for the thousands of musical instruments that had been burnt or crushed, and many talented people had already left Anarquist and continued on their journey rather than turn around. Instead, they'd looked to find more congenial places of employment where booing or a rotten tomato or two was all that they would face if someone was displeased with their performance, and other realms across the continent benefited. Here's more. Yefin developed an aversion to the colour orange and declared he would not have it anywhere in the palace. Citrus growers, among others, were dismayed. It continues. After toying with executing his advisory council, he banished the lot of them, a dozen nobles who must have felt like they'd been treading on eggshells for the whole time of their administration. Yefin replaced them with his favourite dogs. Some of them were hunting hounds, some of them were lapdogs, but we have several accounts of him sitting at the head of the council table with all his dogs in the seats once occupied by the advisers. at least for the start of the council session, because most of the dogs wouldn't sit still and jumped off the seats and ran around barking. Yeffin was said to have directed questions about the administration of the kingdom to each of the dogs in turn, and he would listen, frowning, to what he perceived as their responses. And it doesn't stop there. Yeffin loved statues, and not just to himself, although in the first 6 months of his rule he commissioned dozens of likenesses, which were installed in the palace and through the town. Sculptors made up one of the very few segments of Anaquistian society that benefited from Yeffin's rule. As well as statues to the monarch, Yeffin commissioned statues of many of his forebears, Anaquistian generals from the past, great thinkers, and also statues of his late, fondly remembered pet dogs. Yeffin evinced a wide-eyed horror of spiders as well, but all in all, this is pretty normal, really, not odd at all. It's been much debated how much of this strange behaviour was simply Yeffin indulging himself and seeing what he could get away with as an absolute monarch, and how much was some deep-seated and troubling personality flaw. A point of interest, the Potent Edge, the trio of powerful magic practitioners who made up Zalman's most inner of inner circles, left Anaquist a month after Yeffin was crowned. Whether this was in reaction to Yeffin's attitude towards them or whether it was simply preemptive, it's not known. But the Potent Edge would reappear throughout the 4th and 5th centuries of Anaquist history, always in the shadows, always mysterious. The Drought of 386-387. When I look at the successes and failures of the Anaquistian monarchs, it's clear to me that they can be responsible for much of this success and failure, but sometimes it comes down to just plain luck. Yeffin was doing his best to ruin the land in many ways, but he wasn't responsible for the terrible drought that struck Anaquist's grain-growing regions in the summer of 386-387. While the vagaries of the weather are the farmer's lot, this massive diminution of rainfall was extraordinary in its length and its severity. It wasn't just that no rain fell for months and months and months. It was that the heat was stupendous and the sun scorched the land. Forest fires ran rampant and virtually no grain was harvested for more than a year. Anaquist, for the very first time since it was founded, was on the edge of actual famine. And while Yeffin did his best to ignore the impact this had on his kingdom, the entreaties of merchants and commoners alike eventually made him sit up and take notice. His first reaction, though, wasn't terribly helpful. Yeffin summoned the most important theoreticians and practitioners from the Hypogeum and handed them sketches of a costume he wanted made, replete with the most powerful of scales. Dressed in this, he was said to resemble something like a large fish or lizard, and when it was completed, he stood on one of the larger balconies of the palace and conducted what he claimed would be a ritual, which would bring the clouds to bear, where they would be cowed by his magnificence and would accede to his demand to bring copious rain to the drought-stricken areas. Unsurprisingly, he failed. And also, unsurprisingly, he ordered the chief workers from the Hypogeum executed because they had obviously not constructed his Cloudmaster regalia accurately enough. Yeffin did, however, surprise everyone and thereafter ordered the treasury to release funds to buy grain from other realms across the continent, no matter what it cost, thus preventing mass starvation. A fit of conscience, a belated attempt to curry favour with the common folk, whatever, it was uncustomary, and Yeffin didn't ever do anything so beneficent again. Heaven falls. Yeffin's reign didn't see many heaven falls, and those that did occur were only of minor importance. Some took this as a sign that Yeffin was not favoured by the heavens, but those criticisms, like most criticisms of Yeffin and his rule, were muted. However, a minor heavenfall shower was seen 2 months after Yeffin took the throne. Heavenfall showers are infrequent, but not unknown, phenomenon in the world below the war in the heavens, where multiple objects descend at the same time, creating a display that can be seen over a wide area, and usually sparking a rush to claim the heavenly artifacts, even though most that fall in a shower are small. Observers in Aniquis predicted that the fall would be not far off the south coast of the continent, between Jalox and the mainland, a wild and unpredictable stretch of ocean where there are a scattering of uninhabited islands. With luck, the artefacts would come to Earth on one of these and be recoverable, so Yefin ordered that an expedition be dispatched under royal auspices. 3 months of no news followed, and then a single survivor struggled back to Aniquis to report. She told of atrocious conditions, mountainous seas, and the joy at sighting an island that definitely showed signs of a goodly heavenfall, only to find upon landing that the Jaloxians had got there first. The Jaloxians, having had a few weeks to settle, provision and fortify the site, repelled the Aniquistians with gusto, leaving a single survivor to tell the tale, as is their custom. This being early in Yefin's reign, when, it might be said, he was on his best behaviour, he rewarded the expedition survivor with a small sack of gold. Foreign relations. Yefin's attention to the vital area of foreign relations was about the same level as it was with all other important areas of reigning: erratic. Occasionally he'd pay attention to treaty negotiations or trade agreements, but when he did, it was usually to the dismay of the diplomats who are in charge of these areas. He'd weigh in and make peremptory decisions without reading the necessary documents or even understanding the area under discussion. And, as usual, he'd brook no dissent. The diplomat surely would have preferred him to stick to carousing and wantonness. Indeed, it's been suggested that careful conspiracy among palace officials ran along those lines, catering to Yefin's excesses, cultivating and encouraging them in order to keep him occupied and away from the important areas needed for the running of the land. Relations with other realms were frosty but stable, with no outright declarations of war. Trade was relatively free and encouraged. However, a major furore erupted when a caravan from Inner Honf was impounded and the leader slaughtered because the caravan flew orange flags. A clandestine payment of reparations was made to Inner Honf without Yefin's knowledge. The Temple Dispute. In the last 6 months of Yefin's rule, disaffection was rife in a way it hadn't been in the reigns of his mother and brother. Their stern ruthlessness was basically unquestioned, with their measures swift and dire, which, in a strange way, led to some respect. After all, no one could say they weren't strong rulers. Yefin's capriciousness and self-indulgence, on the other hand, is widely viewed as a sign of weakness. Even though the ferocity of some of his measures was every bit as vindictive as his predecessors. If we add to this the suspicion that the prime temple hierarchy had for the monarchy, after what they saw as the undue influence of the potent Edge trio, some sort of confrontation was inevitable. And, as is often the way with these things, what sparked the confrontation was something minor, almost trivial. In late 387, a grizzled prospector emerged from some years in the wilderness, his loyal mules struggling under the weight of what appeared to be the tip of the tang of a heavenly buckle. The tang was scaleless, but the heavenly metal glowed with the majesty of its own. Alerted by the gate guards in their pay, a standard arrangement, temple ecclesiasts and hypogeum scholars raced each other to see who could first see and claim the find, a happy eventuality for the prospector, as he could see a bidding war in the offering, a not unusual circumstance in those days, before the beginnings of the official artifact trading exchange in the reign of Misti II in 15th century. The fistfight that broke out, however, wasn't anticipated, and soon became a substantial brawl between temple ecclesiasts and hypogeum officials that was only ended when the city guards decided enough was enough and waded in to break it up. This matter was brought to Yefin's attention by one of the sycophants who was brave enough to hover within his orbit. Yefin saw the artifact and took a liking to it, declaring it would be perfect to carry a new royal standard he was contemplating, and he paid the nervous prospector a sum twice what he was expecting, an outcome that was just as likely as Yefin's appropriating the artifact and banishing the old timer from the capital. The temple protested, and the Hypogeum protested at the temple's protests, claiming that the artifact belonged with them. At first, Yefin ignored both parties, and the Hypogeum, seeing the way the wind was blowing, withdrew from the dispute. The temple, however, redoubled its protestations, daring to raise the issue at the royal court, which, by this time, had almost entirely abandoned any effort at being a forum for serious matters, and had become a gathering of debauchery and louche performances, thronging with acrobats, musicians, jugglers, and mountebanks of all kinds. Yefin eventually deigned to hear the temple's case, and an infamous incident occurred when the three eminent ecclesiasts made their argument, were heard, and were then stripped of their robes, painted in rainbow colours, and hurled into the trumpet fountain outside the palace, much to the delight of the toadies in the court at the time, most of whom declared that the ecclesiasts had got off lightly. Months of tension followed, with the temple withdrawing all ecclesiasts from the palace, a move that inconvenienced Yefin not at all, and then removing all ecclesiasts from duties in the Hypogeum. Howls of protest arose from the Hypogeum officials and the traders who were dependent on the supply of scales from the body of the dead god. The economy of Anaquis was jeopardized by the temple's actions, but it was unmoved, asserting that a season of religious devotion, meditation and study was upon them, and attendance were compulsory. Observers were fascinated by the temple's willingness to enter what could become a tit-for-tat exercise, especially since Yefin's tat could amount to wholesale slaughter. But fortunately for the temple, this was forestalled by Yefin's death. A note here. A major and unsettling event in the history of the temple began during the rule of King Yefin, and that was the founding of the Demon Temple. I'll be devoting an entire episode to this troubling and frightening development, so keep an eye out for it. Personal life. As is standard for the Anaquistian monarchs of this time and later, we have depictions on coins, so we know that Yefin was handsome but leaner than his brother. He was also clean-shaven at a time when well-styled facial hair was the fashion. What the coins don't tell us, but we learn from a fragment of a letter, the sender and recipient of which were soon no more, that he was dark-eyed and dark-haired. The vile, depraved, and indolent king, whose eyes are as dark as his hair, and both are as black as his heart. As for his character, his deeds and actions, they're there for us to see, that he was cruel but indulgent, ruthless but feckless, capricious but determined, artistic but boorish. His patronage of the arts was sometimes generous, but seldom long-lasting. Painters, writers, and sculptors quickly falling out of favour, often before the commissions were completed. His court masks and pantomimes were reputed to include some of the highest, wittiest order, but none of them survive. Yefin was occasionally known to take part in the plays written for the court, usually as the romantic lead, and often accompanied by his dogs, who were notorious for chewing the scenery. He did always receive standing ovations from the audience, of course. Negative reviews of his performances were unheard of. The complicated Anaquistian court dances of the time reached a pinnacle in Yefin's reign. Outstanding displays of precision and complexity, possibly because the participants were at great pains to complete the intricate rounds with perfection, fearing the consequences if they didn't. Unlike most Anaquistians to this date, Yefin showed little interest in hunting or the martial arts, and he had no interest in sailing or the boat races on the Gepho, which suffered because of the lack of royal patronage. He was a gourmet of sorts, but paradoxically ate sparingly. He ordered the kitchens to be well stocked with the most exotic of ingredients and insisted on having only the most talented of cooks. He would taste everything that streamed from the kitchen, once the poison tasters were done, but he'd only eat small portions of his most favoured dish. Yefin never married and never had children, which in the end probably was a relief to the realm and made Queen Grippina's succession plan a useful one. Death and the succession. It might come as no surprise that Yefin was assassinated, even though, like his mother and brother before him, he made every effort to rid himself of potential threats by means both brutal and thorough. This time-honoured method always appealed to rulers of a certain caste, but I wonder if they really thought it through. After all, every threat eliminated surely left behind some who were so outraged by this, so angered, that they became threats in themselves, thus perpetuating the threat level rather than diminishing it. But there you go. Once you're on the brutality bus, you tend to stay there, even if you really should have alighted earlier and just gone home. Even though Yefin had done his best to eliminate those who would eliminate him, there were many, many people ready to sacrifice everything for revenge. Looking back, it surely wasn't a matter of if, but a matter of when. The host of potentials included palace officials who had no doubt grown frustrated at his erratic interference with their duties. Also the military leaders who had to suffer his occasional attention to matters of discipline, deployment, and especially uniforms. Then there were the outraged officials in the hypogeum and the temple. And we mustn't forget the common folk, simply fed up with a bad, self-indulgent ruler. Yefin's assassin, however, came from an unlikely quarter. Hiramage was an actor in a troupe that had been plucked out of relative obscurity when Yefin happened to stroll past one of the regular audition sessions conducted by the palace official in charge of entertainment. Yefin liked the light-hearted but profound selection the troupe performed and commanded that they present something similar at the Midsummer Mask in a week's time. Unfortunately, no one told Hiramage's troupe about Yefin's penchant for taking lead roles, and so when he leapt onto the stage at the premiere performance and mangled the entire opening scene, the actors were aghast. The performance didn't get any better, and in the final scene, when Yefin insisted on blowing kisses to his favourites in the audience and asking for drinks to be brought to him, Hiramage had had enough. She jumped from the stage, snatched up a dagger from someone in the front row, and stabbed the king dozens of times in a frenzied attack that was greeted with nervous applause, the audience thinking it was all part of the act. This hesitation allowed Hiramage and her troupe time to escape, unapprehended. Hiramage went on to become a noted playwright in the far-off island of Vesbesili. Yefin's tomb in the royal mausoleum is one of the more unusual in that grand edifice. It's vertical, upright, with an effigy of Yefin on the front in garb of what some have described as a jester. It's certain that he's smiling, but other interpretations of this costume range from that of an actor to that of someone so powerful that their suggestions to their tailor were implemented without demur. The succession went according to Queen Grippina's plan. Yefin's sister Enna had been living a secluded life in a country estate, but she wasted no time in getting to the capital, and she was crowned at the end of 387. Last words. Yefin the Bloody wasn't a dour, stern monarch. He was colourful in many ways, and his conduct was often outrageous. But he was still brutal, cruel, and violent, and his capriciousness made his conduct unpredictable, much to the dismay of those around him. He was not mourned. And that's it for episode 25 of the World Below the War in the Heavens podcast. Coming up next, Queen Enna the Inhuman. Until then, farewell, and may the heavens smile upon you. This has been The World Below the War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the history, culture, and esoterica of the world below, a continent of magic and mystery with inhabitants who keep one eye on the sky at all times. I've been your host, Michael Pryor. If you'd like to find out more about me and my books, pop over to www.michaelpryor.com.au. Farewell!